Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Among the most underrated keys to career success, the ability to persuade. Whether it's to persuade someone to hire you or promote you, to get a customer or a potential donor to cough up their dollars, or to inspire your supervisees. Maybe equally underrated approach to learning the art of persuasion is to examine some of the most influential speeches ever given. And in preparation for this show, I've read 200 of the most influential speeches of modern times, and I've identified 11 excerpts that illustrate a powerful rhetorical device, a powerful tool of persuasion. The first set came from, there's this collection on the internet called American Rhetoric's 49 Important Speeches of the 21st Century. And the first one, the first rhetorical device is saying something that is unexpectedly brave. You've all heard of the preeminent biographer David McCulloch. Well, and he's a very restrained guy. He appeared on the show, quite a restrained guy. And yet he gave the commencement address at Wellesley High School. He lives near Wellesley, Massachusetts. And Wellesley's a very middle-class place. And he gave this absolutely shocking commencement address. I've taken out an excerpt of it, but it's still the longest of any of the excerpts. Most of the excerpts I'm going to read are a paragraph or two. This is about 3 or 4 minutes. None of you is special. You're not special. You're not exceptional. Contrary to what your soccer trophy suggests, your glowing seventh grade report card, despite every assurance of a certain corpulent purple dinosaur, that nice Mr. Rogers, and your batty Aunt Sylvia, no matter how often your maternal caped crusader has swooped in to save you, you're nothing special. Yes, you've been pampered, cosseted, doted upon, helmeted, bubble-wrapped. Yes, capable adults with other things to do have held you, kissed you, fed you, wiped your mouth, wiped your bottom, trained you, taught you, tutored you, coached you, listened to you, counseled you, encouraged you, consoled you, and encouraged you again. You've been nudged, cajoled, wheedled, and implored. You've been feted and fawned over and called sweetie pie. Yes, you have. And certainly, we've been to your games, your plays, your recitals, your science fairs. Absolutely, smiles ignite when you walk into a room, and hundreds gasp with delight at your every tweet. Why, maybe you even had your picture in the Townsman. And now, you've conquered high school. And indisputably, here we have all gathered for you, the pride and joy of this fine community, the first to emerge from the magnificent new building, but do not get the idea you're anything special, because you're not. The empirical evidence is everywhere, numbers that even an English teacher can't ignore. Newark, Natick, and Needham, yes, there has to be at least 2,000 high school graduates right there, give or take, and that's just the neighborhood ends. Across the country, no fewer than 3.2 million seniors are graduating about now from 37,000 high schools. That's 37,000 valedictorians, 37,000 class presidents, 92,000 harmonizing altos, 340,000 swaggering jocks, 2,185,967 pairs of Uggs. But Dave, you cry, Walt Whitman tells me I'm my own version of perfect. Epictetus tells me I have the spark of Zeus. And I don't disagree. So that makes 6.8 billion examples of perfection. 6.8 billion sparks of Zeus. You see, if everyone is special, then no one is. If everyone gets a trophy, trophies become meaningless. I also hope you've learned enough to recognize how little you know. How little you know now at the moment. For today is just the beginning. It is where from here you go that matters. The fulfilling life, the distinctive life, the relevant life is an achievement. Not something that will fall into your lap because you're a nice person or mommy ordered it from the caterer. You'll note the founding fathers took pains to ensure your inalienable right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Quite an active verb, pursuit. Which leaves, I should think, little time for lying around watching parrots roller skate on YouTube. The first President Roosevelt, the old Rough Rider, advocated the strenuous life. Mr. Thoreau wanted to drive life into a corner, to live deep and suck out all the marrow. The poet Mary Oliver tells us to row, row into the swirl and roil. Locally, someone, I forget who, from time to time encourages young scholars to carpe the heck out of the diem. The point is the same. Get busy. Have at it. Don't wait for inspiration or passion to find you. Get up. Get out. Explore. Find it yourself and grab hold with both hands. So, nobody has ever expected at a high school graduation to get that. And yet it went down as one of the 49 important speeches of the 21st century, even though it was a high school graduation speech. A little side note. Note the use of the repetitive. It's additionally powerful when you give examples. You say, yes, you've been pampered, cosseted, doted upon, helmeted, bubble-wrapped. Yes, capable adults with other things to do have held you, kissed you, fed you, wiped your mouth, wiped your bottom, trained you, taught you, tutored you, coached you, listened to you, counseled you. Notice the more the impact is, but they're brief, they're rhythmic. Those are rhetorical tools that can be used in every work context and every out-of-work context, and yet that's not the kind of career advice you're normally going to hear. And now I want to turn to Apple's Steve Jobs, who gave the commencement speech at Stanford University. And the last that we're talking here about, saying the unexpectedly brave. Well, Jobs did that. The last thing you'd expect him to say was that dropping out of college, remember, this is Stanford's commencement address. The last thing you'd expect him to say was that dropping out of college after one semester was, quote, one of the best decisions I ever made, end quote. But he did. That, and he said that up front in the beginning of the speech, that made clear to the graduates that they'd be hearing his truth, not a pile of positioning that's often the domain or the de rigueur practice in commencement speeches. Here is a little excerpt, much shorter than the previous one, I promise, so all the rest of them. I've got about 11 here. Jobs said, I naively chose a college that was almost as expensive as Stanford. And all of my working class parents' savings, this was a guy not born with a silver spoon in his mouth, and all of my working class parents' savings were being spent on my college tuition. After 6 months, I couldn't see the value in it. I had no idea what I wanted to do with my life and no idea how college was going to help me figure it out. And here I was spending all the money my parents had saved their entire life. So I decided to drop out and trust that it would all work out okay. It was pretty scary at the time. But looking back, it was one of the best decisions I ever made. There's no better way to establish your credibility than up front in a talk, even if it's a 2-minute presentation at a staff meeting, saying the honest unexpected. Yes, to be really honest with you, my dear listeners, sometimes you pay the price. And the question I ask without really being a leading question is, we all pay a price for integrity. The question is, when is it worth it? Not always. I know that for sure. The next rhetorical device in some of the great speeches of modern American times is to preempt a key objection. Many people, when you go in to give a talk, again, even if it's a 2-minute talk at a work group, there are very often objections that people are likely to raise. And if you don't preempt the objection up front, their mind is going to be distracted. They're not going to hear a thing that you say. So it's very important to preempt important objections up front. The best example I came up with, and I really love this one to tell you the truth, is this was at Robert Byrd's funeral. And I'd imagine that everyone at Robert Byrd's funeral was thinking about the fact that he had been in the Ku Klux Klan. A Democrat had been in the Ku Klux Klan. But certainly no one would mention that in a eulogy. No one, that is, except Bill Clinton, who realized that the credibility of everything else he would say would rise if, before launching into the usual expected praise of Robert Byrd, he first dealt with Byrd's Klan experience. This is what he said. There are a lot of people who wrote these eulogies for Senator Byrd in the newspapers, and I read a bunch of them, and they mentioned that he once had a fleeting association with the Ku Klux Klan. And what does that mean? I'll tell you what it means. He was a country boy from the hills and hollows of West Virginia. He was trying to get elected. And maybe he did something he shouldn't have done. And he spent the rest of his life making it up. And that is what a good person does. Pretty good, huh? Bill Clinton, one of the greatest rhetoricians of all time. Another example of preemption comes from another Democrat, Louisiana Governor Kathleen Blanco's speech in response to the community's fury at the federal government's slow yet expensive response to Hurricane Katrina. She knew that her conservative audience, this was she spoke this to the legislators, which was conservative in Louisiana, she knew that her conservative audience would be skeptical of any more taxpayer spending, so she preempted the objection. I assure Congress and every American taxpayer that every nickel will be properly spent. I will appoint an outside financial accountability advisor, someone of unquestioned character and reputation, to work with our Inspector General, Legislative Auditor, and Commissioner of Administration to safeguard this investment. I'm also issuing an executive order directing state agencies to limit spending and allowing them to put state employees to the best possible use in this recovery. Boy, that's got to soften the heart of even the most tight-fisted conservative, no? The next rhetorical device. First, I'll let our listeners know. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. I am performing excerpts from some of the most influential speeches of modern times, American speeches, having reviewed 200 speeches from collections of best speeches to pick out 11 excerpts that I thought would be particularly valuable to you, useful in the workplace, of course, as well as outside. The next rhetorical device that I want to demonstrate is appealing to an apple pie value. This is from Duke University President Richard Broadhead, following the revelation that the media, and in turn the public, had prematurely deemed Duke lacrosse players guilty of rape. When I look back through the whole complex history of this case, the scariest thing to me is that actual human lives were at the mercy of so much instant moral certainty when the facts were not yet at all established. If there is one lesson the world should take from the Duke lacrosse case, it is the lesson of the danger of prejudgment and our need to defend against it at every turn. Given the power of this impulse, and given the forces that play to it in our culture, achieving this goal will never be easy. All the more reason why it's a fight in which all of us need to do our part. Much of me hopes that the Duke lacrosse case will someday be forgotten. But if it is remembered, let us hope that it is remembered in the right way, as a call to caution in a world where certainty and justice come much too fast. It's an apple pie value, not prejudging. Innocent till proven guilty. He invoked a core value as a way of bringing people around. The next set of excerpts comes from American Rhetoric's 100 Best Speeches of the 20th Century. These three clearly influence powerful tactics of influence. This is the power of opposites. This is from John F. Kennedy's inaugural address, and it demonstrates that juxtaposing opposites enhances clarity and memorability. It's a very brief one. Let us never negotiate out of fear, but let us never fear to negotiate. Let both sides explore what problems unite us instead of belaboring those problems that divide us. I would imagine that has a certain relevance today. The next rhetorical tactic is the power of threat. This is a less quoted part of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. It addressed what had just occurred, the recent Birmingham riot. Dr. King realized that even in a speech that largely encouraged peaceful action, a threat can have powerful impact. Those who hope that the Negro needed to blow off steam and will now be content will have a rude awakening. if the nation returns to business as usual. And there will be neither rest nor tranquility in America until the Negro is granted his citizenship rights. The whirlwinds of revolt will continue to shake the foundations of our nation until the bright day of justice emerges. If he had been threatening in the entire speech, the speech would have long been forgotten. But just as a boss who rarely yells, but when it's really important, does yell and has impact, so did Martin Luther King in his I Have a Dream speech. It was all about peace and kumbaya, but then there was that paragraph, the power of threat. The next rhetorical device that was used by a great speech among the 100 best speeches of the 20th century is from Barbara Jordan's keynote address at the 1976 Democratic Convention. And this excerpt demonstrates rare candor about her fellow politicians not walking their talk, which of course increased the credibility of the rest of her speech. We call ourselves public servants, but I'll tell you this. It is hypocritical for the public official to admonish and exhort the people to uphold the common good if we are derelict in upholding the common good. More is required. More is required of public officials than slogans and handshakes and press releases. More is required. The next rhetorical tool used in one of these great speeches, this is from Ronald Reagan's Mr. Gorbachev, Tear Down This Wall speech, 1987. There is one sign the Soviets can make that would be unmistakable, that would advance dramatically the cause of freedom and peace. General Secretary Gorbachev, if you do seek peace, if you do seek prosperity for the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, if you do seek liberalization, come here to this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, open this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. And finally, here are excerpts from three speeches from other sources that demonstrate a powerful rhetorical device. This is the rhetorical device of the power of inspiration, and this is from William Faulkner's Nobel Prize acceptance speech. I believe that man will not merely endure. He will prevail. He is immortal, not because he alone among creatures has an inexhaustible voice, but because he has a soul, a spirit capable of compassion and sacrifice and endurance. The poet's, the writer's duty is to write about these things. It is his privilege to help mankind endure by lifting his heart, by reminding him of the courage and honor and hope and pride and compassion and pity and sacrifice that have been the glory of his past. The poet's voice need not merely be the record of man. It can be one of the props, the pillars, to help him endure and prevail. The next rhetorical device is the power of the literary, from a very unexpected source. General Douglas MacArthur? This was from his retirement speech. The shadows are lengthening for me. The twilight is here. My days of old have vanished, tone and tint. They have gone glimmering through the dreams of things that were. Their memory is one of wondrous beauty, watered by tears, and coaxed and caressed by the smiles of yesterday. I listen vainly, but with thirsty ears, for the witching melody of faint bugles blowing reveille, of far drums beating the long roll. In my dreams, I hear again the crash of guns, the rattle of musketry, the strange, mournful mutter of the battlefield. But in the evening of my memory, always, I shall come back to West Point. Always there echoes and re-echoes duty, honor, country. And finally, the power of invoking the broadest implications. This is from Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from this earth. So, the takeaway, think about the next talk you have to give in or out of your workplace, even if it's just a 2-minute presentation at the next staff meeting. How might you use one or more of these devices of influence, these rhetorical devices from great speeches? I'm going to summarize. Saying the unexpectedly brave, as Steve Jobs at the Stanford graduation did, saying that dropping out of college was one of his best decisions. Should you preempt a key objection like Bill Clinton did before launching into his eulogy for Robert Byrd, having been in the Ku Klux Klan? Or appealing to an apple pie value, as the president of Duke did after the lacrosse the players scandal did, in urging us to remember that our system of jurisprudence's core principle is innocent until proven guilty? Or should you use the rhetorical device of the power of threat, as Martin Luther King invoked in his I Have a Dream speech, in which he warned those who hoped the Negro needed to blow off steam and will now be content will have a rude awakening? Or the power of candor, when Barbara Jordan, in front of an audience of politicians, said, "It is hypocritical for the public official to admonish and exhort the people to hold the common good if we are derelict in upholding the common good." Or the power of a call to action, as exemplified by Ronald Reagan at the Berlin Wall. "If you seek liberalization, come here to this gate, Mr. Gorbachev. Open this gate, Mr. Gorbachev. Tear down this wall." Or the power of inspiration, as exemplified in William Faulkner's Nobel acceptance speech. The poet's voice need not merely be the record of man, it can be one of the props, the pillars, to help him endure and prevail. Or the power of the literary, as exemplified, perhaps surprisingly, in General Douglas MacArthur's retirement speech. "In the evening of my memory, always I come back to West Point. Always there, echoes and re-echoes, duty, honor, country." And finally, the power of invoking the broadest implications, as Abraham Lincoln did in his Gettysburg Address. "We here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from this earth." And those are, I think, important rhetorical devices, as well as just humanly inspiring, I think, to all of us. We've all listened to speeches in hopes of being inspired. And how wonderful, thanks to Google and the Internet, that I was able, in a relatively short time, to identify 200 of the best speeches and share 11 excerpts with you like this. It was a privilege for me, and I hope you enjoyed it and maybe gained something from it. But now, we turn to the practical, and that is you. A major portion of the show, or major function of the show, is to help you with your specific work-life problem. All this lofty rhetoric is all well and good, but if you are struggling, whether you are unemployed, underemployed, or well-employed and still miserable, whether you're self-employed, employed by a company, a nonprofit, a government agency, if you are unhappy, 16 or 76, if you've got a work problem, I think it's 27th year I'm doing this now, and I'm eager to continue helping you. You can tell in my voice, I'm as enthusiastic about helping you today as I was when I started. So I do these things called workovers. I invite you to call. The price is certainly right. Zero, zippo, nada. I will do my best to help you. The phone number here at KALW for a workover, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Okay. While we're waiting for calls to come in, I do a lot of tweeting. I consider Twitter an outstanding place to post your soundbite thoughts that you want to keep. And so I, in preparation for today's show, I also reviewed, I've written, I think, 3,800 tweets or whatever. So I reviewed a bunch of my tweets over the last year and picked out those that I think might have particular relevance to you. The first section of these, I put them in categories. This is called bad choices. And here was a tweet. Does your opinion of a person change when they start or end an email with Happy Friday? If so, does that make your opinion of them more positive or more negative? When I posted the tweet, I asked that question. I got a number of people saying almost everybody agreed it made it more negative. This Pollyannish pop pleasantness reeks of disingenuousness. Yeah, I guess that's the right word. Be careful with those kind of phrases, like, you know, well, it's hump day. Any of those little Pollyannish statements impose risk, especially among well-educated people. I noticed, by the way, that, you know, among my clients, it's the least educated among them in general who use those little slogans. So be careful. The next bad choice is, this is a quote from Neil Simon. This is, again, a tweet about a bad choice. Neil Simon wrote in the play Broadway Bound, which I believe is his best play and yet far from his most famous, the smilers got to be the salesmen. The smilers got to be the bosses. Your father paid the price for not being a phony. And it's related to the previous tweet. There is this, you know, the smiling salesperson, the same person who says, Happy Friday, you know, awesome, have a great day. Those people tend to be viewed, people tend to worry. People who have a genuine smile is lovely. It's winning. Every study of influence shows that a genuine smile, you know, wins friends. But be careful about the plastic smile. It's amazing how sensitive people can be to micro-expressions, little tiny changes in the way of a smile. A smile that doesn't have, for example, your crow's feet on the side of your eyes is phony. A smile with your lips closed is a forced smile. People are not consciously aware of it, but when they see smiles like that, it reeks of phony. Be careful. A third one is a bad example of a tweet that demonstrates a bad choice is the eminence, eminent people, the eminence urge us to be bold and honest. Alas, many who do lose their jobs or their reputations or their friends. We don't hear much about those people. It's very easy for an eminent person, that's the end of the tweet, but it's very easy for an eminent person to encourage honesty. But frankly, and I've said this before, especially in the Bay Area, honesty, unless it conforms to the orthodoxy of Bay Area thinking, can really get you in trouble at work. So, next one, bad choices. This tweet is a quote from Margaret Thatcher. If you set out to be liked, you would be prepared to compromise on anything at any time, and you would accomplish nothing. That's the end of her quote. It's really tough. You know, we know we live in a non-meritocracy. There are many factors other than merit that get included in a hiring decision. And one of those factors is people who are likable, and that can often compensate for a lack of competency. So, and it also makes us make compromises. So I'm not, you know, so, you know, there's a Jewish or German term called Luftmensch, head in the clouds with the feet nowhere near on the ground. I'm not saying that you avoid being liked and just, you know, speak your truth and do your truth or whatever, but you do pay a, you know, price when you're so worried about being liked that you compromise who you are. And it's also that huge price that it really is, you know, a major example of dishonesty to realize that deep down you're really not that competent. You're going to try to get by being nice. It's one of those under-discussed, sleazy behaviors. All right, I want to give out the phone number again. If you or someone you care about has got a work-related problem of any sort, I can usually help with what I call a workover. This is Work with Marty Nemko, and the phone number for a workover here at KALW is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Next in the realm of tweets, if I can find them. Yes, here they are. This comes from, these are just kind of miscellany, but I find them interesting. Christina Hoff Summers is a scholar on gender and feminist issues, and her perhaps most famous quote, which I requoted here, is, "Want to close the wage gap? Step one, change your major from feminist dance therapy to electrical engineering." So think hard about your career choices. Let's put aside the question of how much glass ceiling exists and doesn't exist. I was listening to, certainly on Philosophy Talk the previous hour, where it was almost accepted that that glass ceiling is a cabal of males conspiring to keep women from getting ahead. But let's put that aside for the moment. Certainly, agency is one of the most popular words in the feminist literature. And certainly women have the agency to choose to major in biology. And by the way, now 52% of all PhDs in biology go to women. You have choices. And, but I cannot tell you how many clients I've had who do the metaphorical equivalent of majoring in feminist dance therapy. And then they complain they're not making a good living. We make choices. If you want to be, if you want to prioritize being a homemaker or having children and being there for your stay-at-home mom, great. But we all make choices. If some guy chooses to focus on building his ship, and taking a part-time job, he really wants to build his ship or whatever, refinish his boat or be a, make custom furniture. Those are perfectly appropriate choices, but then he can't complain that he's not making enough money. Phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko for a workover, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Let's go to the phones. Welcome to the show. It is your turn on the air. What's on your mind? How can I help? Hello?
Hello?
Hi.
It is me. Okay.
Good. Is your phone down? I'm hearing a little hum. I don't know if it's coming from your end. Is your radio down? Volume down?
I have my windows open in my car. I'll close it and pull off the road here.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, is that better?
I think so, but please go ahead.
Yeah, I've enjoyed listening to your show in the past. I usually do my Sunday morning workout at the Y, and then on my way home I tune in.
Thank you.
In the last 30 days, I've had a work change.
Okay.
I didn't change work. My work changed because the old boss sold his company to a new guy with a new company. Same building, same clients, same all that. The new company offers a 401k,
mm-hmm.
which I'm happily taking.
Right.
Turns out the old company offered a 401k and neglected to tell me about it.
Mm.
Is there a path forward for me to be compensated? Is there only civil? Is there any kind of civil satisfaction or legal satisfaction? Criminal satisfaction?
I'm not a lawyer. The normal KELW answer is call your legal rights, on which is on Wednesday night, 7:30. But that said, I wonder what there's a term going to be called constructive notice, and I'm wondering whether was it in the when you were hired, was the company big enough to have an employee handbook? Is it on the website that they encourage you to look at? Is it possible that they told you or that they will claim that they told you but you didn't remember it or you didn't hear it in the middle of all the hiring? Those are some questions I would raise, in discussing as you bring it up, say in your legal rights or if you go to legal aid or hire or talk to a lawyer, I would raise those issues. Does that make sense?
Yes. Prepare myself for those questions. Yes.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. There was no company handbook. There is no company website. Never was. It's a very small company, 10 or 12 people.
Right. And how would you respond to the notion that said, of course we told him about it. He didn't take advantage of it.
Well, in the new organization, I was given a piece of paper to either sign or not sign, which says, I'm aware of this and I'm not taking it. Or this other piece of paper that says, I'm aware of it and I am taking it. And I didn't receive either one of those in the previous company.
Yeah, I don't know if if it's a legal requirement to have written in writing that a 401k is available. That is well beyond my expertise.
Okay.
They could say, we're a small company, we're just a startup, we didn't have that kind of paperwork. We told him about it, he didn't remember it, he didn't hear it, we don't have any obligation to have him sign up.
Right. Okay. All right. No, yeah. I'll be prepared for that. You're right. I should absolutely take this up. It's not a trivial amount of money involved here.
I understand. The question is, now, when you got your pay, when you're in the old company, did you get your pay stubs? You got pay stubs, right? They were like,
yes. Oh,
and
yeah.
Did the pay stub have a blank that, you know, there are normally, when my wife, for example, gets her pay stub, it lists a number of categories, including those she didn't participate in. Now, is it possible that your pay stub had a blank that said 401k contribution 000?
You know, I can definitely check that. I know that the new company had made gave me an online
I know
presence.
That's irrelevant. The point is the previous,
yeah.
You know, if your old employer simply waives a pay stub every month, he got a pay stub and it said 401k contribution 000, and you know, you could be, those are the issues,
yeah,
that I think you would have to sufficiently address, and then
right.
Ask yourself, if it's at all vague, is it worth the legal costs and the time and stress of trying to sue? Those are my thoughts.
Yes. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Great show. Thanks.
I do my best. Phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko if you have a work over. Again, I'm not a lawyer, but I have an opinion about every damn thing under the sun, if it's at all related to work, even if it's indirectly related to work. For example, your relationship problem is keeping you from doing your best job at work. We can talk about that. What if, you know, I do watch Shark Tank at times, and sometimes I say to myself, geez, I'd ask harder questions or smarter questions than some of those questions they ask at the Shark Tank about potential business owners. If you are thinking of starting a business and would like me to ask some good hard questions to help you decide whether you should move forward and how, or you're running a business and it's, you know, you'd like to see it do better, all those are good reasons. Anything related to work directly or indirectly are good reasons to call for what I call a work over here at KALW and Work with Marty Nemko. Phone number 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Okay. Back to some tweets that I thought would be relevant to you that I wrote recently. This one is about writing. I do a lot of writing. And this says, write as bold a draft as you like. Then, before sending it, step away and later reread it to see how much, if at all, it should be tempered. It's kind of back on that same theme of how bold should you be? That boldness doesn't have to be defined by political correctness. It can be defined by many things. But we tend to either pull back too early and we write a draft that's too tepid and therefore perhaps be under bold, if that's a word, it's probably not, or we write something that's really bold and we send it away without thinking about it. We pay a price, especially today, for being too bold. So I don't want you to give up on boldness, but the right balance is struck by writing as bold a draft as you can or want to, then step away and with fresh eyes, at least a few hours later, it didn't have to be a whole day, then look at it and ask yourself, would the wise man within me, wise woman within me, would I temper any of this, or might I even get bolder? Anyway, we've got plenty of calls on the line now, so let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It is your turn on the air. How can I help?
Hi, is this me?
It is.
Oh, man, I just love you. You are brilliant.
Thank you.
And when you had your wife, Barbara, you guys are just brilliant. Okay, here's my question. How do I retire gracefully? I've just signed up for Social Security. I'm 62.
We just lost you, I'm afraid. So feel free to call back. We got you. About to retire at 62. Want to retire gracefully? Let's see if I can help. It's a great question. Happy to help with your address. Let's go back to the next. Let's go to the next line. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Hi, Marty.
Hi.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm on the other side of the spectrum. I'm meeting with my son today, who was brilliant and gifted academically, graduated top of his class,
okay,
both from Lowell and UC, and then he keeps trying to pursue these sales jobs, and he wants to excel in sales, which is a big surprise to us because we never expected that would be,
right.
You know, we thought he might be an academic or something that was a little bit more intellectual, but he's very driven, and he seems to, you know, and sales seems is such a tough row to hoe, and he's actually, you know, he's improving and he's getting better and I have to let him make his mistakes as he makes them and learn from them. But what can I do? What kind of input can I give him? And what would you advise for from your point of view, could he pursue if he's interested in sales and really making money?
Love your question. I would probably, if I was his dad, I would probably probe a bit on his motivation to make a lot of money. What's that really about? People who go into sales, yeah, they see big dollar signs.
Mm-hmm.
And so I want to understand at risk of sounding like a shrink, are there fears that are undergirding it? Is he really afraid he's going to be non-self-supporting? Is he afraid of, you know, why? What's behind, you know, sometimes,
well,
go ahead.
I think it's because both his dad and I have pursued passions. His dad's a very accomplished architect, and I've been a project manager, and I think we've pursued passions and interests that were somewhat, you know, they were remunerative, but they weren't like stratospherically rewarding as some of the careers are. That, and he sees his uncle, who's in sales, doing very, very well, or has done well. And I think he wants to be, you know, a top earner. I think that's really what his goal is.
Why? Because he wants to buy stuff, or is he playing the numbers game that numbers define his worth?
No, I mean, you know, to afford to buy a house, to do anything in the Bay Area of significant, to create significant security, you have to make a lot of money.
All right, so let's assume that that's because we're not going to go down that path of accept as given. Okay, fair enough.
Right.
So what would I tell my son or daughter who wanted to go in sales? First of all, I would say, because you've got greater intellectual firepower than the average salesperson, you should sell a difficult-to-sell product that's going to utilize all of that brain power. Because therefore you're going – so, you know, if you're selling – for example, I'm making stuff up here as I go along. But if you're selling $100,000 software that's going to be used by the architecture industry – you know, that is really hard to explain and really hard to sell and a long sales cycle and you're dealing with really smart people, he's going to make more money and there'll be much fewer people competing. I would also, you know, there is tremendous ethical compromises. There's such temptation. If you're money driven, there is so much temptation to hide the truths about your product or service. And at the risk of my getting, you know, be sounding sanctimonious, I would beg my son. I said, or daughter, of course, if you really want to make money, fine. But you know what? I'd rather you be not the best salesperson. You can still be an average salesperson and have complete, perfect ethics and make enough money. That way you can use your brain. If you're selling an expensive, high-value product that you absolutely have to believe in, it's got to be a product. I'm staying with the architecture thing because of your husband. If he's going to go there, he should only sell the very best product, the product that is most worth the money, that is perhaps is most wise, where he can go to sleep at night and tell his future children, I am proud to have sold this product. That's got to be number one. And then number two, he really, really should, if the product is not, he talks to a customer, and even if he's gone a long way down the sales cycle, and they're about to buy, and his professional judgment is they'd be better off with the competitor, I would urge him to say, you know, the more I get to know your situation, I think you'd be better with the competitor. He will lose that sale and may not derive any benefit from it. He might, but probably won't. But he will sell enough. That kind of this may sound silly, but the old Christmas movie, The Miracle on 34th Street, was all about the head of Macy's inadvertently, the Santa Claus, telling the customer, the Santa kids, to go to Gimbel's, the competitor. That's my best thoughts. What's your reaction to my reactions?
Well, you know, I know that adage about Macy's, and it worked for Macy's, but that's really not an issue for him. He's a highly ethical person.
Great.
Simultaneously, he's very ambitious at the same time.
Okay, that's fine.
So I think that's your advice, though, to sell a more complex, more intellectually challenging product is very good, because he also finds the thing that he's doing very redundant right now.
Exactly.
So, I think with that advice, where he's using his intellectual gifts more to challenge himself, is really, I like that. Thank you.
I'm not letting you go yet. Not just a complex product, but a customizable product. Many products where the real intellectual capability comes in is, how might it be customized to meet the needs of that?
Right.
That's a more intellectually challenging thing.
Okay.
And then one more thing, which is that normally salespeople, no matter how complex the product, no matter how customizable, smart people burn out on sales. And so he needs to view sales as a stepping stone to more intellectually challenging work. Because companies live and die on numbers, he should envision himself becoming a vice president of sales at a great company. So think of this not as an end place, but as a launch pad. Does that all make sense?
That's great. Any companies you would recommend?
Well, I like the idea of building on where he's got extant knowledge. So who is he working for now that
he's working for a project planning software company. I don't want to name any
names. That's fine. I can only say that it should, ideally, for a starting place, should be, because he's not going to get hired for a great sales job in something new. If he knows nothing, for example, about bank security software, he's probably not going to get hired. So he's got to leverage his existing knowledge, whether it be from his current job in project planning software or from your work or your husband's work or something where he brings some content expertise, what they call domain expertise, to the table so that he's more likely to get hired for a good job. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that does make sense. I think, though, that he has, he has worked for Spotify and he's worked for other companies, so he has, already acquired some experience in other markets. So, but that is really good advice, and I like the idea of what you said. First, let me see if I can rephrase this. To customize, choose something that can be customized for the customer, and also from a company where he can advance his sales ability to a better position.
I would also avoid designer label companies like Spotify, because everybody's into music or sports or political activism or the environment, so the competition is bizarre for good sales jobs. I would choose something that was under the radar.
That's what he's been doing, actually.
Okay. Well, that's why I mentioned, for example, the bank security software. Nobody graduates college, even from Stanford or whatever, saying, I think I want to sell bank security software. Right? But there's going to be his opportunity to sell that complex product. As long as it's best in class and it's customizable, he will have a much more rapid rise through the ranks and make more money and make a bigger difference as long as he keeps his ethics number one. There is rule, because even if he's, everybody starts out ethical. Nobody says, I want to be a sleazebag. Everybody starts out their career wanting to be ethical, every single one, including the sleaziest, corporate lawyers.
But even Donald Trump?
I'm agnostic on that question.
Okay, we're not going to do
But yes, I'm agnostic on how ethical. He really did start out not so great. Even then, I'm a little concerned about him. I'm a little concerned about him. So, but I do think that if you make, there are going to be such pressures to make your number. They do it subtly. They don't do it like in whatever that, what was it, that real estate pressure say that play.
Glenn Ross.
Glenn Ross, the David Mamet play, right. Yeah. They ain't going to be that overt. Make your number. But
that's one of his favorite movies.
Well, good. Then that should be a cautionary note. And the way you can also resist that is during the interview process, he needs to ask them questions as well as them asking him questions that will assess their integrity.
Yeah.
And of course you got to do it. Nobody's going to say I'm a lying, dishonest fool. They're going to say, tell me, every manager has a different approach to sales management. Tell me what are kind of the guiding principles that are going to undergird your managing me. Tell me, what would you really expect if, let's say, a customer said they didn't want to buy our software after a while? What would your honest reaction be to that? And listen carefully, and you'll get a better sense of whether this is somebody you want to work for, and therefore more likely to resist the ethical temptations.
Right. That's all good. That sounds good. I like it. I've got enough to go on now. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks a lot for calling Work with Marty Nemco.
Bye.
Bye. Okay, phone number again if you want me to, try to help you with your problem, any work-related problem for yourself, your kid, relative, friend, lover, whatever. Phone number for a workover here at KLW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. I've been interspersing some of my favorite tweets that are relevant to career in between calls, so I'd like to share this one with you. In choosing a career, see if you can picture yourself in it, literally picture yourself. I've found among my clients that seems to be quite predictive of whether you'll actually go for it. It's visual. We can, could you picture yourself being the accountant, like, or the architect, like the previous call? Could you picture yourself as a project manager? Could you picture yourself raising money for a nonprofit? Could you picture yourself working for a government agency? What could you picture? Okay, now let's go back to the phones. I'll give out the phone number one more time. 415-841-4134. What's that, the number for? A workover here on Work with Marty Nemco and KELW. Welcome to the show. It is your turn on the air. What's on your mind? How can I help?
Hi.
Hi.
So I'm a recent college graduate. I graduated in fall of 2014.
Okay.
And I immediately went into my field, which is in labor. I'm a union rep.
Okay.
So I'm very young in this field that usually is like dominated by an older group.
Yep.
So I realized that I enjoyed what I was doing, but I couldn't see myself doing it for a very long time, so I moved into a different position, but I still stayed in the same field, and I recently relocated from Chicago to the Bay Area. So the cost of living is way higher here than
here.
In Chicago.
It is crazy.
So,
yeah.
And I expected that. So when I came out here, I knew that I was taking a slight pay cut, but as a 24-year-old, I have no debt, no college debt, nothing like that at all. So I was like, I can afford to take a little bit of a pay cut. However, I will not stay where I'm at for longer than maximum 24 months. So how long is too long to stay? Because now I've been here for about 5 or 6 months in this position, and I'm not seeing the growth potential that I thought. I'm not seeing my company developing me professionally like I would have assumed, or like I had the support back in Chicago. And I really stayed in the company, just transferred to a new office. So how long is too long to stay? Is 2 years too long?
Oh, absolutely. You know, you should be, you know. Well, first of all, I like to look at foundational things first. There is a continuum that explains why a company might not be supportive. One is they're simply inept. They have a lousy, self-absorbed manager who's lazy, or they're overwhelmed on one end of the continuum. The other is they just don't see you as high potential, and so they put their resources elsewhere. If you trusted the goddess within yourself, the wise woman within yourself, where on that continuum do you think is the reason why they have not provided the support you'd hope they'd give you?
I think it's within management. I don't think that they were actually capable. They made this really big deal about, oh, we would love to have you because of your experience and we've already seen your work potential. But when I got here, they pretty much threw a big mess in my lap and said, we know you can do it. Now please help us clean it up. And then my supervisor actually got fired.
Okay.
So it was kind of a mess, and because of the experience I had, I was able to identify, like, hey, these are the things that are not correct that's, you know, keeping me from being able to move the project forward, whereas my coworkers here were they were relatively young as well. However, because they didn't have experience in another office, they didn't even know what to identify as being wrong.
Okay. What I would suggest is you start looking immediately. There is,
okay.
You know, of course there's a benefit to staying 1 year or longer in a job. It shows stability. But that's not what's called a trumping, pardon the expression, advantage. It's a minor advantage. It's much worse for you to stay stultified, not growing. You're 24. Really, it's a great time to start growing your career. So, you know, I would be making without quitting. You know, it doesn't sound like you're getting, you know, it's not horrible. It's just not a growth. It's kind of dead-endy. So, you know, you're getting a certain amount of autonomy. There is an advantage of saying throwing you in and do it. So, you know, do it. Try to get the help you can in and outside of your organization, among your friends and colleagues, internet. Do what you can to do a good job so that you will end up getting a better reference. But if you feel like this is not a good launch pad for your growth, I would start looking. And I would make a list of the top, if you are still interested, for example, in being a union rep, I would be making a list of the unions that are local to, you know, geographically. If notwithstanding the cost of living here, you're still committed to staying here in the Bay Area, I would make a list of the 10 unions that have a significant presence here in the Bay Area, and I would write them a letter. I'd apply for jobs that are publicly advertised, but I'd also write a letter to the person who would hire somebody who would hire union reps and explain your situation. You don't want to badmouth the previous organization, but say you feel it's dead end and you feel that you're looking for other opportunities. And that way you're attacking it through both the front door and the back door. The front door is answering the ads, but the problem with the front door is that there's usually dozens of other people, especially in the Bay Area where everybody tends to be very pro-union. There are going to be a lot of applicants for those jobs. But you're also trying to get in through the back door by either directly contacting the employer who's not advertising a job, or if you've got a network, maybe even in your current job, although you've only been here 6 months, you may have already made some friends or colleagues within your field and see if they, you know, tout what your best strengths are and see if they might open some doors for you. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that is great advice.
Was it clear enough? I talk so damn fast. Is there?
No, it's fine. It's actually, no, I'm accustomed to the fast talk. I'm from Chicago and Detroit, so I'm used to it.
Okay. Is there anything else you want to ask me before you go, or do you feel like you've got enough for me now?
No, I actually feel like that validates thoughts that I was already having. Of course, being new in the workforce, you don't know, you know, what's too long. You don't want to stay stagnant. So I think it was great.
Yeah, stay. No. You need to start looking. You know, you don't have to get out tomorrow, but you need to start looking now.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for calling Work with Marty Nemco. Appreciate it. We only have a couple of minutes left, so I'm not going to take any more calls. Here are a couple more of the tweets that I was telling you that I was. That I picked out of my 3,800 tweets that I think are relevant to you here at Work with Marty Nemco. These are principles that I try to live by, and I swear I'm not trying to be sanctimonious. I'm just trying to share the best of what I've got. This tweet was very short. It was, tell as much of the truth as you can. And that's so, you know, it's silly and simplistic to say always tell the truth. It just, sometimes the price is too great to yourself or to the other person. I won't normally, let's say, if I have a client who's morbidly obese, you know, the truth would be to tell it, damn it, you've got to get weight loss surgery, or you got to lose weight somehow. But if I sense that she's resistant to it, or it's not the right time, or the relationship hasn't been developed enough for me to be able to say that, I won't always say it. But I like the rule of thumb that you tell as much of the truth as you can. The next one, and I've said this many times on the show before, but it's so important, it's my core principle. Make most of your heartbeats productive. Another, that's a really short little soundbite. But your life's value is far more in your contribution than in your happiness. I know a number of people who are not happy, but they feel good about the life they've lived because they've done the things they thought were going to leave the world a little better. Even if, and it's not, I'm not just saying it's, you know, certainly if you're, you know, working for some great nonprofit you believe in, that's very obvious, certainly by Bay Area standards, is a way to make a difference. But whatever it is, whether, you know, you're a stonemason or you're a project manager, sometimes you make the decision that you would rather spend hours 40 to 50 during a week working on your projects so that your coworkers and your customers or whatever are happier than, you know, doing things that aren't going to make as much difference, going to the ball game, giggling with friends, going shopping. So think about making, I mean, that I like that philosophy of life. Make most of your heartbeats productive. And another one I try, a principle I try to live by that I think is really important, is again really short, always think cosmically. What are the effects of your doing and not doing something, not just on you, not just on your peers, not just on society, but in terms of the universal cosmic right and wrong, like the son of that woman who called. I don't mind anybody being a salesperson. A salesperson can be really very valuable if, in fact, the person is, you know, the product is really great and really would make a lot of people's lives better and make the world better. So thinking cosmically, I think, is really, really very valuable. And that's all the time we've got. One more thing. Live simply, please. Recognize you pay a big price for more buying more than basic versions of things, and it also creates more ethical temptations. If you buy, a Mercedes, then you're going to feel like you got to make more money. It's not going to increase your happiness, and it's going to increase your ethical temptations. Okay, that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do workovers on callers. And should you go back to school, my wife, Barbara Nemco, and I are going to do a switch sides in the middle of debate on that very question. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.